couple of years ago, Adam Gopnik wrote an article in the New Yorker about faith and belief, and he said that we know that in the billions of years of the universe's existence, there is no evidence of a single miraculous intervention with the law of nature. That is an extraordinary statement of dogma and faith. How do we know that, and how could we know that? And the reason he can make that statement is because of his presupposition. In his worldview, all that exists is the natural. Supernatural does not exist, and therefore any evidence of a supernatural event must have naturalistic evidence. Therefore, of course, it can't be a miracle. All that exists is natural. Miracles are supernatural, so miracles can't exist. About 1908, Chesterton wrote published an article in response to people back then, over 100 years ago, who had the same perspective. So the perspective is not new to our time. He said, "My belief that miracles have happened in human history is not a mystical belief at all. I believe in them upon human evidences as I do in the discovery of America. Upon this point, there's a simple logical fact that only requires to be stated and cleared up. Somehow or another, an extraordinary idea has risen that the disbelievers in miracles consider them coldly and fairly, factually, while believers in miracles accept them only in connection with some dogma, an article of faith. The fact is quite the other way around. The believers in miracles accept them because they have evidence for them. The disbelievers in miracles deny them because they have a doctrine against them. It is we Christians who accept all actual evidence. It is you rationalists who refuse actual evidence, being constrained to do so by your creed." We've been in the Gospel of Mark since the beginning of the year, and one thing that's clear is this is a book of miracles from beginning to end. And Christianity is a miraculous faith. The gospel is a miracle of the incarnation. God became man, the substitutionary atonement on the cross, and the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. And the Greek word for miracle is a word that means sign. And as we've discussed over and over again, a sign points to something other than itself. And the signs and miracles point to Jesus. They authenticate his message, his mission, and his announcement. They point beyond themselves to ultimate reality. But very often, humans have, in the Bible and even now, turned the signs into an end in themselves. So it'd be like if there was a sign saying Mount Everest, and it was pointing to Mount Everest, and there was someone standing there staring at the sign, and someone taps them on the shoulder and said, "Mount Everest," and they're staring at the sign. Here's this thing of majesty and splendor, and they're captivated with the sign. The miracles, they're neat, but they're nothing like the one to whom the miracles point to. We're in Mark 6:53, and what happened was you had the feeding of the 5,000 plus, and then the disciples were wore out, and they row across the lake in the wind, and Jesus went walking on the water to them, and now they land on the other side of the lake. As soon as they landed there and anchored, they got out of the boat, and people recognized Jesus, and they ran throughout the whole region and carried the sick en masse to wherever they heard he was. And wherever he went, in the villages, towns, or countryside, they placed the sick in the marketplaces. They begged him to let them touch even the edge of his cloak, and all who touched him were healed. So, back on this side of the lake again, and lots of folks are being healed, some just by touching his clothes. And John writes in his gospel, using hyperbole, to let us know that the things we have written down, the gospels, are just a fraction of the miraculous things Jesus actually did. John 21:25, he said, "Jesus did many other things as well. If every one of them were written down, I suppose the whole world wouldn't have room for the books that could be written." So let's talk about miracles today, since they're a prominent feature of the Bible and our faith. You know, if the Red Sea parted next Tuesday at noon, and a group of people walked across on dry land, it would not be considered a miracle by secular people, by scientists who don't believe. They would think it's a natural occurrence. They may not know why it happened, and they may spend years writing papers on it. Someone would probably get a PhD in it. But what if a large group of people were fleeing from a murderous king on foot, and his army was breathing down their neck, bent on destroying them, and they get right up against the sea, and just then their leader, who is a proclaimed spokesperson for God, and he raises his hand, and just at that moment the sea parts, walk across on dry land. Just as they get to safety, the murderous army comes in and they're destroyed. The sea closes on them. It would take a great deal of faith to call that a set of coincidences, a great deal of faith to not call that a miracle, but that's what would happen. If that happened, just like that today, there are people who would say, I don't know what just happened, but I can tell you there can be no miracles. That was not a miracle. And that's the climate that we find ourselves in. In 1820, Thomas Jefferson, who was a deist, and so a deist believes there's an impersonal God who made everything, but he's uninvolved in the process now. He's absolutely transcendent, but not immanent. And he produced his own Bible. We have a copy of it. And he took a little sharp knife, and he cut out the piece of the Bible he didn't think belonged there. He believed that Jesus was the greatest ethical thinker of all time, but he didn't believe in the supernatural. There's a natural order. There is a creator, but he's uninvolved. Natural processes run their own. So his Bible is quite a bit shorter. And in his Bible, Jesus teaches, but he does no miracles. Jesus dies and is buried, but he stays dead and stays buried. Sometimes Christians feel sheepish when admitting to a belief in miracles, especially if talking to a person of science or someone they think is more erudite than they are, as if science could somehow disprove miracles, which of course it can't, or as if education and intelligence presupposes you have to not believe in miracles, which of course they don't. Now, scientists can presuppose that miracles don't exist, but this would be a statement of faith, not a statement of fact. So if someone says science has proven miracles don't exist, there's no science in that statement. That's not based on evidence, but a belief system, a sort of religion. And in fact, if people were open to the possibility of miracles, the facts are firmly in their favor. There was a philosopher, a mathematician, died a few years back named Ludwig Wittgenstein, and he said that the great delusion of our times is that the laws of science explain the universe for us. He said the laws of nature describe the universe, but they explain nothing. A miracle is the interruption of the natural processes from outside the system. So we have a natural order God's made, and a miracle would be an intervention in the natural order, the way things normally work. So we don't believe that Jesus rose from the dead through some natural process. That would be impossible. In the natural order in which we live, there are no processes in existence that would allow a three-day dead man to come back to life. What we believe is that God injected power into the natural process from where he exists, apart from our system. So the deist God is far off. He's transcendent but not involved. The Christian God is bigger than the universe. He's not tied to it, but he's involved in it. He's no deist God. He's involved. So the scientist who says miracles can't exist because all that exists is a closed system, the natural order, is using circular reasoning. So if you said all that exists is a natural order, what would it require for you to make that statement dogmatically? You'd have to either be outside the natural order and looking at it, or you'd have to have someone from outside tell you that that's the case. Of course, then if someone told you from outside the order or you lived outside the order, then there's more than the natural order. It's a self-refuting argument. The evidence within the system we live in, the universe, the physical world that God's made for us, has always pointed to a designer. The psalmist a few thousand years ago wrote, "The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they display knowledge." 200 years ago, William Paley, a scientist, used his famous watchmaker argument. If you find a watch sitting there keeping time, ticking, you would naturally assume there's a watchmaker. See, a watch is a watchmaker. And some have tried to refute Paley's argument using other arguments, and nobody's really been successful. But Paley didn't even know how truly complex the watch is 200 years ago. The current science reveals more design than people even 25 years ago could have imagined. 12 years ago, the most prominent atheist of the 20th century, Anthony Flew, discarded his atheism and became a Christian, but he became a non-atheist. And he came to the conclusion that an intelligent being must have made the universe. And he was 80 years old. It made international headlines. His followers became angry and disillusioned because he was undermining their faith and disbelief in God. And he came to this conclusion based on his study of the complex genetic code in DNA, and he said, "You can't account for this apart from a designer. It's not possible." He was an honest man. He didn't become a Christian, but he did become a non-atheist. So the evidence is there everywhere in the existence of the physical world we live in, as well as the signs that God has planted in the natural order. And those signs planted in the natural order point to someone much bigger than just the natural order. And in fact, the natural order itself points to a designer. We've seen lots of miracles in Mark. We're going to see lots more in the next 6 months. So today we're going to talk about the topics of miracle in a little bit more detail. But let's start with the universe itself. The ground where God plants his signs is a sign in itself. After all, just because we're used to the natural world doesn't mean it's natural in origin or that it's not miraculous in origin. Christy and I watched a sci-fi movie last weekend, and one of the characters says something like this. It's a paraphrase, but I've heard it a dozen times in different movies. There are so many planets in the universe that you don't even have a number big enough to describe them, and you're so arrogant to believe you're the only planet with life. And this is usually being told by somebody on the planet, by some alien. And it's a common statement in movies, sounds good, but it's actually very outdated science. There are so many conditions that are absolutely necessary for a planet to support life that it is improbable to the point of impossible for life to exist on other planets. And it's really scientifically and statistically impossible for life to exist here. You say, well, Terry, I don't think you quite understand the word impossible because we're here. And what I said was it's statistical and scientific impossibility. Otherwise, that's known as a miracle. It shouldn't be here. There are hundreds of examples. You may have seen some of the great videos that are out, some books that have been written, and the evidence is piling up. There's more all the time. Let me give you just a couple of thoughts real briefly. If the Earth were a little bit larger, it would have more gravity, and the atmosphere would be made of methane and ammonia. We don't do well breathing methane and ammonia. If it was a little bit smaller, water wouldn't stay down. It would go up in the atmosphere. We don't do well without water. Speaking of water itself, there are large number of material written on the miraculous nature of just water, something that's everywhere. You know, water becomes more dense until it hits 39.2 degrees, then it starts becoming less dense, so by the time it's frozen, it floats. And that way, lakes don't freeze from the bottom up, killing fish. So water has all these really fascinating qualities, all of them essential for life as we know it. If the Earth rotated a little bit slower than it does, day and night would be deadly, the temperature swings. If it rotated more quickly, it'd produce impossibly high winds. Jupiter has 1,000-mile-an-hour winds. And speaking of Jupiter, if we didn't have the big fella out there, space junk would hit us 1,000 times more frequently. It has 318 times our gravity, and it's made of gas, so it just sort of swallows stuff whole or bounces it off of our solar system. If the moon were a little bit bigger, our tides would be over 100 feet. If they're a little bit smaller, there'd be no tides, and coastal seawater wouldn't be cleansed and replenished. Life as we know it wouldn't exist. If the moon were a little bit different distance away or a little bit different angle, there are so many factors that add up in staggering fashion. In fact, the odds of a planet supporting life based on the known factors, and we're getting more all the time, right now is 1 in 10 to the 50th power. That's an impossibly high number. Fred Hoyle, who years ago, before we even had the evidence we have now, he's an astronomer who was an atheist, who changed his mind. He's the one who coined the term Big Bang. He said, a common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with the physics as well as the chemistry and the biology. The numbers one calculates from the facts seem to me so overwhelming as to put this conclusion beyond question. So with all this evidence, and it's stacking up all the time from their own scientists, what have scientists done? Have they turned whole scale to belief in a supreme being? No, the current answer for the clearly miraculous nature of the universe is a theory of multiverses. The idea that there's an infinity of universes out there. And of course, if there's an infinity of universes, then by chance, one will possess all the variables perfectly right for life to exist. We are the lucky ones who live in that universe. And there's a physicist, a well-known physicist named John Polkinghorne, who said, let us recognize these speculations, the idea of an infinite number of universes, and we live in the lucky one, for what they are. These are not physics. These are metaphysics, a faith system. There's no purely scientific reason to believe in an ensemble of universes. And Richard Swinburne, who's a philosopher and theologian, he's a little more direct, he said, to postulate a trillion, trillion universes rather than one God in order to explain why the universe is full of order seems a height of irrationality. So life itself is a miracle. We know that the universe is not self-creating. It was designed by God. He made it as our home. Who created God? No one created God. God is uncreated. Something's always been here, physical or God. The facts point to God. And once you conclude that God made the universe as a miraculous act, it's easy to believe he can do any sub-act within the universe as well. So if he can make an ocean, he can split one. If he can create life from scratch, he can bring one back from the dead, and so on. So let's get personal about miracles, because even if I believe miracles are possible and historical, what difference does it make for me? It's an important question. Let me give you three reasons why it's important. First, some people live for a miraculous experience. They feel like they need a miracle to authenticate their faith. And so if you hear of some strange phenomenon, the image of Jesus on a taco shell, or a person back from the dead, or a healing, people flock to that place. Why? Because they're desperate for proof that this is not all there is. The new TV series comes out in 2 weeks. It's called Proof. It's about a surgeon who searches for proof of life after death. A movie 25 years ago, Flatliners. Same medical students looking for proof that there's life after death. But you know, a miracle has never fixed anybody. Not in terms of taking away the need for ongoing faith or obedience or endurance. Look in the Bible. Elijah saw a lot of miracles. In fact, one time he saw this amazing set of miracles, and the next thing we find him is depressed and wanting to die. So much for being fixed by miracles. Last week, our boys saw Jesus feed 5,000 plus. A couple hours later, they're all screaming in fear on a boat. So much for being fixed. Years ago, I personally experienced a public and, for me, a very powerful miracle. A lot of people were there and saw it. And I asked my mentor the next day, I called him and said, explain the situation. I said, what do I do with this? He said, well, when you got up this morning, were you fixed? I said, huh? He goes, were you fixed? He said, you have to get up and have a quiet time? Yeah. You have to choose to love your wife? Yeah. You have to choose to go to work? Yeah. When you put the thing in your backpack and you keep walking. Miracles point us to Jesus. He's our all in all. We don't need them in order to know him, trust him, and love him. And to look for a miracle to fix your faith is like going on a cruise to fix your marriage. A cruise can make fun memories in a good marriage, but it's a temporary distraction at best for a bad one. A miracle won't fix a heart that's far from God. What'll fix a heart that's far from God is to train in godliness, to move towards Jesus. Ask the boys in the boat from last week's narrative. A miracle is no substitute for training in godliness. We don't need miracles to love God, but we do need to learn to love God. Second reason is some people feel like second-class citizens in the kingdom. They're riding in coach, maybe get a pack of peanuts thrown to them. Others are in first class, getting full meals, because they haven't gotten their miracle. Some of the greatest Christians of worldwide impact left no record of having experienced a miraculous event in their life, like Lewis and Wilberforce and Newton and Bonhoeffer and many others. Some will say, well, that's because they didn't have faith. Really? Okay, give me their lack of faith. I'll take it. Or some will say, well, they just didn't write it down. In that case, you proved my point. They wrote a lot of stuff down. If it wasn't worth writing down, it didn't make the cut for them. Now, of course, they did technically experience a miracle. Conversion to Christ is certainly a miracle. And third, we sometimes wonder what's appropriate to ask for. What should we believe is possible for believers now? There are those whose theological systems don't allow for miracles. Some forms of dispensationalism don't allow for miracles. Some forms of liberal theology don't allow for miracles. There are those whose religious systems, Christians, their systems require miracles, or you don't have real faith. So what do we do with this? Are these ancient artifacts not to be experienced today? Are we supposed to be seeing a miracle a minute, and it's our lack of faith that prevents us from experiencing this? How do we apply these narratives to our lives? So I'm going to tell a few stories, illustrative stories, and I'm going to tell them briefly because I've told most of them, maybe all of them before. And then I'm going to tell you why I told them to you. I was on an old rig in the summer of 82, and I was walking on a deck underneath the main rig about 30 feet off the ground. I was looking for a pipe. It was 11 o'clock at night, and I had not a wind, but I had two hands that hit me on my chest like that. And there was no hands there. I was by myself. And I took my breath away, and I looked, and my next step, the gangplank was missing, and I would have fallen down to some pipes about 30 feet below me. When I was in college, a friend of mine and I, we went to New York City over spring break, and we were walking around Bed-Stuy and Harlem just sharing our faith. And this is not a miracle, but it was interesting. I was thinking about this story this week, and my friend David Knight, who was with me, called me. I haven't talked to him in probably 15 years. So he called me this week, David and I were walking around, and it was about 11 o'clock at night. We were standing outside the subway station in Harlem, and we're the only Caucasians around that area. And this other Caucasian came up. You guys have heard this story before, some of you. And he looked at us, was stunned to see a couple of white guys standing there at that time, and he said, "Do you know where the nearest bar is?" We said, "No." My friend David says, "We got something better for you." So we were praying for God to direct us, and we were standing there, and this man walked up. So we went down back underneath the street and began to share the gospel with him. He got on his knees, prayed, began to weep. He looked up, and there's graffiti everywhere, most of it nasty, and right by where he's praying, there's somebody written, "God loves you." And then he said, "You know, I was on my way to leave my family." He said, "I left work. I went the opposite way of my house, got off here at Harlem Station, was going to get drunk, and then I'm going to leave my family." And he got on the train, subway, and went back to his family. So some would say, that's an interesting series of coincidences. And I would quote George MacLeod, who said, "If you think that's a coincidence, I wish you a very dull life." Ernest, maybe you know Ernest, he had a dream one time where there was a friend of ours who was making a series of bad choices, and then his family was trying to cover it up, trying to put a spin on it so nobody would know the bad choices. And in his dream, of course Ernest didn't know that, we didn't know it. In his dream, he's in a room and this family walks in and begin to describe this elaborate story, which is really a lie, to make themselves look better. And in a dream, Ernest sees through what's going on and calls them on it, and they repent. About a week later, he was in a room, and he looked up, and here comes his family, and he recognizes the room, and they start talking, guess what, describing this elaborate story. And Ernest just says, "Let me finish your story for you." And they were shocked. They said, "Nobody knows." He said, "God knows." And they repented of the ruse. So I've experienced more than that. If we shared stories in this room together collectively, from maybe even just a friend of mine told me that God would, in a situation where he required really some help, where God gave him some, he felt like some information that he couldn't have had on his own, we could share a ton of stories and come up with a lot more. And the point of telling a few stories is to illustrate the point that we live in an open, not a closed universe. God still intervenes in our natural order when it fits his purposes. And I picked just a couple of stories that I can personally verify rather than something I read in the book or magazine that I can't verify, because sometimes people will try to help God out by elaborating or inventing stories, and that doesn't help anybody out. So the question is, why doesn't God intervene more often? Why doesn't he do something miraculous for more people or more overtly or more often? What is his decision-making matrix for miracles? I mean, with all the suffering in the world, it sometimes seems like he chooses to do petty miracles and not act when the stakes are high. I mean, someone's excited. I read a story about this amazing series of events, unexplainable, really, how someone, their car keys just appeared somewhere. I mean, really, why would God provide car keys and allow a child to die of cancer? Seems like a misuse of miracles to me. God give him the miracle. He's dying. I can get some more keys made. Don't waste a miracle on me. Well, it's not like God's a genie with limited wishes. And his signs are not wishes, they're signs. They point to him. So God alone knows how and why the signs he uses accomplish his purposes. And as best I can tell, we're to ask God for what we desire, ask him for what we want. He's not a genie, he has three wishes. You know, you can ask him for missing car keys or heal a headache or whatever. You're not taking some wish away from some sick kid somewhere. But the whole point of all this is to have hearts that are growing to the point where he is our chief desire. Pray for what you desire, but above all, pray that he becomes your chief desire. And that's our lifelong journey. We want to grow in confidence in him so that we're able to trust him in everything. Which brings us to an important question. If we thank God for the good things, why not blame him for the bad ones? One person glows about God's love because God provided in miraculous fashion. Another person is devastated because they didn't have their prayer answered in the way they hoped. God answered it. He said no to them. So the happy person with the answered prayer is told, praise God. But the devastated person would never be encouraged, blame God. I know of a man, I talked to a friend about a guy who he works with this week, and he said, this man believed God, was believing God for his wife's healing, and she died last year. And now he's double devastated. The loss of his wife of many, many years and the loss of his confidence in a certain type of faith in God. But of course, he's encouraged even now to do what? Trust God and not blame him. So it seems like it's always with God, heads he wins, tails we lose. I mean, the athlete who points his finger to God after making the game-winning catch, why doesn't he raise his middle finger to God after dropping the game-losing catch? And I'm not trying to be sacrilegious or funny here. People are asking this question. If you'll listen, and it's being asked with some degree of anger sometimes. You Christians are stupid. You can't have it both ways. If you're going to thank him for the good, you need to be prepared to blame him for the bad. This is one of the prime arguments that a lot of the leading atheists have had, like Chris Hitchens. Either I must blame God for the bad as well as thank him for the good, or I don't get to thank him for the good at all. But that's not true. I can thank God in the good and the bad. I can learn to trust God for all that he brings into my life. Does this mean you have to thank God for evil done to you and to others? No, evil's evil. It does mean we can come to the point where we believe God is able to bring good from anything, that nothing surprises him, nothing overpowers him. He's ultimately in control. He's not just watching uninvolved like Jefferson's God. You know, we really don't have to understand everything in order to trust him. We just think we do. If you don't think it's possible to trust without complete knowledge, you haven't considered a small child lately. They do it every minute of every day. They live trusting without complete understanding, and they do it quite well. You say, well, that's a child. So are you. So am I. On a relative scale, there's adults and children. On an absolute scale, I hate to tell you this, we're children, and he is our father. And we don't have to have complete understanding to have complete trust. We really don't. We have adequate understanding. That's what the cross is. The cross is the final adequate understanding. Does God love you? Is God powerful? Is God there? There's the cross. What about this? What about this? What about that? Great questions. But it's normal and healthy to not want to suffer. It makes really good sense to avoid suffering when you can. I advise it all the time. Physical, mental, relational. And so it's expected that if we believe in a God who intervenes in national order, that we would ask him to take suffering from us and those we love. That's appropriate. Look in the Psalms. They're praying in the Bible. They're praying for an intervention in what? God, remove suffering. Keep me from suffering. If I have a headache, I'm going to take an aspirin, go to the doctor and pray for God to heal me. It's good. It's appropriate. It's normal. We want to avoid suffering as much as possible. Nothing wrong with that. But that being said, life is more than just avoiding suffering. In fact, people who lived only to avoid suffering live a life of suffering without meaning. I'm not going to suffer relationally, so I'm going to avoid close relationships. Well, you're going to suffer a lot. I don't want to suffer physically, so I'm going to give all my time and effort to avoiding disease and injury. I'm going to give all my time to health, in which case you start worshiping your body and fearing what your body will do to you, in which case you're going to suffer. Life is not about avoiding suffering. It's also not about embracing suffering. That's the Buddhist philosophy. Life is about the glory of God, relationship with him. And we are going to suffer, but we don't have to suffer without meaning. C.S. Lewis said, if the whole universe has no meaning, we should never have found out that it has no meaning. Just as if there were no light in the universe and therefore no creatures with eyes, we should never know it was dark. Dark would be without meaning. Why do we pursue meaning with such diligence? Because life is about meaning. There's a movie came out about the life of Stephen Hawking. Maybe you saw it, The Theory of Everything. Won an Academy Award, Best Actor, based on his ex-wife's memoir of their love relationship, which ended in divorce. And Hawking is one of those guys whose answer for the obvious design of the universe is a theory of multiverses, infinite number of universes. He said the universe is self-creating because of gravity. When asked where gravity comes from, he said, in theory. We're just a lucky universe where the impossible happened. But Hawking has spent his life trying to create or find meaning. It's been the driving force in his very difficult and somewhat admirable life. But why? How does his worldview explain this innate need for meaning? How come those who say the world is without ultimate meaning other than what we can create ourselves live otherwise? It's because meaning is hardwired into us. There's meaning because God exists. He meant to create us. We mean something to him. His existence is the foundation for meaning. And so the meaning of miracles is in the context of the meaning of everything else. It's just like people try to find the meaning of marriage all by itself in an autonomous fashion, never succeed. But when you understand the meaning of life as the glory of God, then the meaning of marriage starts making sense. It's a subset. The meaning of parenting, the meaning of work, the meaning of recreation, they're all subsets of the meaning of everything. Colossians 1:16, for by him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers of authority. All things were made by him and for him. God is our greatest good. He's not the theory of everything. He's the explanation. He's the reason, the purpose for everything. So any and everything that happens in our life that points us to him is good. Any and everything done by him is done with intelligence and good purpose. So why would God intervene to pay for an electric bill in the nick of time for somebody using miraculous circumstances and then not intervene to heal a cancer? I don't know. I do know it's vitally important to trust God's decisions, because life, if it's nothing else, is about training to trust him. And there are a million paths that people take in this training. This room is full of different paths that we're on in this training. It's the same goal, become conformed to the image of Jesus, but many different paths. John 21:17, Peter denied Christ three times, and so now the resurrected Christ is going to give him a chance three times to not deny him, to affirm his allegiance to him. And so he asked him three times, do you love me? And Peter was hurt. When the Lord asked him the third time, he said, Lord, you know all things. You know I love you. And Jesus said, well, then feed my sheep. So I tell you the truth, when you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go. And Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. So the Lord has given him his mission, feed my sheep. He's even given him some insight on how he's going to die. And Peter, according to church history, died crucified upside down. And so then he looked at him and said, Peter, follow me. And what did Peter do? In classic Peter fashion, he looked over at John and said, what about him? What about him? And Jesus said, if I want him to remain until I return, what's that to you? You must follow me. So the Lord's given him great instructions on his life, and he does what we're all prone to do. What about him? What about her? The Lord's response is, how is my plan for him your concern? How does my plan for him or her have anything at all to do with my plan for you? And my plan for you is follow me. And we have to follow the Lord on the path he's laid out for us, and we can't afford to be sidetracked by the path and the plan he has for other people. Can you trust him with this? Can you trust him with this? I mean, that's the question for all of us. It's a question for me. Can I trust him with this? If I experience miracle after miracle, or I see nothing that looks like a miracle in my life, the challenge and the opportunity is the same for every one of us. You must follow Jesus. There's different paths. Same ultimate goal. And for those who know and love God, same outcome. And the great equalizer in the end is all those who love him, know him, they end up with him, seeing him. They all end up equally blessed in the end. All of us. And I'm telling you, whether you experience a lot of signs planted in the fabric of the natural order or you didn't see any signs planted in the natural order, it's not going to matter at all. What matters then, what matters now, is love him. And everybody, whether you see a sign that says Everest on it or not, everybody who loves him gets to see Everest. So in the end, who cares if you see a sign that says Everest? Let's pray. Father, thank you that all of us who have been born again have experienced a miracle. You have intervened in the natural order and done that which is supernatural. You've changed our hearts, changed our lives forever. And Father, I say for me, and I think for many of us, that there are a lot of things we want, a lot of things we desire, but what we want, what we want to desire the most is for you to be our chief desire. Whatever else you do, we want to know you and love you.